announcements. First, the reader, which you will need soon, is available in Coffee Central. The price is about $25.
From Cody O'Brien, right?
Discipline and Punish,
yes.
So, we start Discipline and Punish. Well, probably in reality,
probably next Thursday. We'll see. Second, the blog is going fine. There's much on the blog to help you figure out Durkheim and Obama. They go together. Third, there's a review session later today. Anybody interested in coming? Okie dokie. 4 o'clock. I was going to do it in 475 Farrows, but I think I will do it in 100 Lewis, just in case there's not enough room in 475. Yes, Matthew? 100 Lewis. Where is Lewis? It's somewhere near... Oh, that way. Just go through the wall. It's on the east side, going up to the hills. Okay. 100 Lewis, bring a jacket. It's cool in that room. But I will warm you up. Bring questions.
How are you doing with your mission? How are you doing with your mission? You haven't started writing. VJ, how are you with your midterms? You haven't even started. Has anybody started? That's encouraging. You're Monica, right? Now, Monica, tell me, what would you say if I gave you a bit of extra time?
I would enjoy it, but I feel like there's a catch.
There's a catch. What do you think the catch would be?
No.
Okay. How long would you like, Monica?
Tuesday, we probably won't get to Lenin Gramsci, though we might get to Marx. Okay?
So it's due in your TSI box is 3 p.m. Wednesday. So that means you can go to the beach on Monday. Any questions? So, all right, after this is 100 Lewis. 100 Lewis. All right. Summary.
Oof. Any questions? Oh, yes.
There was one other thing. There was some confusion about the question number one. I'm asking you there to compare the theories of history, the motives of history, the four dimensions of what's a characteristic of grand theory. I want you to actually talk about Marx as well as Durkheim. How much you talk about Marx is somewhat up to you, but you can't just jump straight into Durkheim. I want there to be a comparison, an articulate comparison of the two theories under these four dimensions.
In fact, you can definitely say that on that point.
If you put Marx, you write about Marx, it'll be clear that there are certain things missing in Durkheim. And you may want to make the argument, that Durkheim doesn't, well, he doesn't deal with history in the same way anyhow. Yeah, well, that'd be very good. That's why, you know, you've got to say something about Marx to make that point about Durkheim. So I want you to actually, Marx will appear in it. How much is Marx, I think, is somewhat up to you, but there should be plenty of other Durkheim, obviously. And it should be a comparison. There's no point in just telling me what Durkheim thinks about the theories of history. That will not do. As Sebastian said, definitively, you've got to compare the two. Am I being too well here? Yeah? Good. Right. Okay. Any questions?
Going. Gone! Cool. Right. All right. Okay.
Look. Summary. There are essentially two transitions that Durkheim talks about. The first transition is one that we have talked about already. It is essentially the rise of the division of labor. Before graphically, the increase in the division of labor over time. And the story is this: we move from mechanical solidarity based on a strong collective consciousness, measured by a law of repressive law, essentially repressive law, to a situation ultimately of organic solidarity based on the division of labor. And what Durkheim says is that this is measured by a decline in repressive law. Hold on. Yes. The repressive law. And don't forget, there's going to be some collective consciousness down here. Strong collective consciousness here. Strong CC. And here we have, remember, a weaker collective consciousness. You see, individuals have three consciousnesses. They have their individual consciousness, they have their localized consciousnesses, according to the groups they belong to, then a national collective consciousness. And so there's going to be, as we described it before, a weakened, leprosized collective consciousness that contains the morality of cooperation, social justice, and the cult of the individual, and then there are these petals, which are the consciousnesses of the occupational groups. This is the sort of necessary condition for this division of labor to lead to solidarity. Anyway, the repressive law declines and the restitutive law increases. And we characterized this last time, there's your history, Jessica. We characterized this last time as Book 2, Chapter 2, and how does it look? It looks like this. The alphas, the betas, the gammas, then their coalescence, leading to increased moral density, leading to what? The struggle. Competition, leading to new needs, fatigue, resources, leading to division of labor that will supply the new needs if and only if there's a sufficiently strong collective consciousness and regulation to avoid struggle leading to colonization, suicide, and genocide. The same story, essentially. That is one story of transition. Now, there's another story. And it's an interesting question, why exactly is the relationship between these two stories? And this is the transition from what? From the abnormal division of labor to the normal division of labor. And the normal division of labor gives rise to what? Solidarity. And the abnormal one gives rise to conflict. Here again, we have a picture. Over time, what we see is, I'm going to draw a picture of the changing amount of solidarity. In the beginning, we got mechanical solidarity. And then as the division of labor develops, mechanical solidarity. As the division of labor develops, so what happens is there's transition, there's turmoil, there's conflict. And so in a sense, conflict diminishes. Conflict increases and solidarity diminishes. And then, so this is the moment of the abnormal division of labor. And we talked about the anomic division of labor last time, we talked about the forced and discontinuous one this time. And then, what those kind of things, if that's the abnormal ones, then hopefully what will happen is what? Solidarity will increase. And we will get the true organic solidarity. Then we have what? The normal division of labor. You see, all around our time, you see conflict and struggle. And so we said, well, it seems reasonable that people, like Marx, like socialists, would say that division of labor inherently leads to conflict. And he said, no. It is only the abnormal form of division of labor that leads to conflict. When the abnormal one becomes truly the normal division of labor, then we get solidarity, organic solidarity. And I refer you again to the passage I read at the end of last time, page 307-308, the very last paragraph of book 3, chapter 1, the Genomics Division of Labor. It's a beautiful account of what he understands to be, what he understands to be organic solidarity. The feeling of unity with others. That even somebody who is putting a pin head on a tin store can feel unity with his or her fellow workers by virtue of the common project. Where's Waffle? Waffle, we had a conversation. Waffle came and talked to me about her institution that she has chosen. She's chosen what you've chosen. Theatre, performing arts. But theatre, do you know that is the perfect example of organic solidarity? In theatre, everybody has their distinctive what? Roles. And if something doesn't turn up, you're in deep trouble. So everybody is dependent upon others, and yet everybody has that feeling of unity with others, seeing a common project as theatre production. That is a great, great example of organic solidarity. Yeah. Projects. People feel they specialize, but they also feel unity with others. So, that would be over here. The problem is that most of society, when Durkheim is writing, and one might argue now, we will talk about it later, but Durkheim is saying that most of the position of labor is not normal, it is abnormal. And so, what we have to see is what the abnormal forms are, and then see how we can mend them, or whether they somehow spontaneously go from abnormal to normal. Okay, Christy? Good. Now, the question is this. What goes over here corresponding to that? That is where I'll get to at the end of today. This is a graph, and I'm going to give you the sociological picture. Now, so we're going to need to talk about these different forms of abnormal division of labor. We talked about the anomic division last time, the state of deregulation, the concept of anomie spread throughout the entirety of the discipline of sociology. And it is amazing that this, whether it be social movement theory, as it used to be particularly, why do people engage in collective action and protest? Because they're confused and disorganized. Deregulated. Normal. Why is it that we have gangs and drugs? No, we have, because disorganization. People are modes of transition in their lives and between spaces. We are permanently in transition, permanently in a state of deregulation, a state of anomie, and therefore we behave in all sorts of strange ways. I think sociology has come along a little bit, but still so much sociology is actually shaped by the idea of anomie. Basically, Durkheim, and it's invented, of course, by Durkheim. Durkheim is basically saying, in this chapter, book one, book three, chapter one, he is saying, essentially, that the state of deregulation, is the result of transition from mechanical solidarity to organism. It's a state of transition corresponding to the development of division of labor. It is the fact that the division of labor is developing and disorganizing the relations among people that we get conflict and confusion and disorganization and struggle. Yeah. And in fact, that struggle up here is corresponds to that anomic division of labor. And so he says, we just got to do what? Wait for the transition to be over, and then, Bob's your uncle, hunky dory, division of labor leads to solidarity. Right? We got it. Yes? That's right. You understand? The transition just going to be over, and then, division of labor will lead to solidarity. You understand the argument?
Yes.
Good. Warren. Well, we got one version of it up there. This one is what we're going to do. That's right, that's only 2, 3, 4 question marks. That's right, no, this is the question. This is the key question for Durkheim. We're going to see that is the essence of the problem. So, you have to wait. Yes. Right.
The division of labor, this was a
wait
for the division of labor to change. Court was supposed to be thinking that it happened naturally,
You've obviously been reading this. It's a fantastic page 310, 311. Book out, book out, book out. Yes. Okay, look at.
Well, if you look at the opening paragraph, he says, why does their class struggle? Because people find themselves in positions for which they are not talented, not full suited.
If you look at the bottom of the page, this is a total giveaway.
Total giveaway, bottom of page 310, last line. We are certainly
We are certainly not predestined from birth to any particular form of employment.
We are not predestined.
But we nevertheless possess, tastes and aptitudes that limit our choice.
We're not predestined, but we are clearly potentially different.
We have different tastes and aptitudes. A very clear statement of the idea of natural abilities.
If no account is taken of them, if they are constantly frustrated in our daily occupation, we suffer and seek the means of bringing that suffering to an end.
Yes, indeed. And then the next paragraph.
This condition is not realized. Indeed, next line. Second line of the second of the new paragraph. Indeed, if the institution of class or caste sometimes gives rise to miserable squabbling instead of producing solidarity, it is because, and I hear Durkheim is quoting Jessica, who wrote it first, it is because the distribution of social functions on which it rests does not correspond, or rather no longer corresponds, to the distribution of natural abilities.
Very good. If you drop down to the bottom of the page, 2, 4, 6, 8 lines from the bottom of the page.
Through these transformations, the congruence in a whole sector of society was broken between the aptitudes of individuals and the kind of activity allocated to them.
Constraint alone, more or less violent, more or less direct, henceforth binds them to these functions. In consequence, only an imperfect, troubled form of solidarity can exist if people do not have the opportunity to find their natural place in the division of labour.
Such an outcome, this troubled solidarity, is therefore not a necessary sequel of the division of labour. It only occurs in very special circumstances, that is, in an
abnormal form when it is the result of some external constraint that prevents people from entering into the places for which they are equipped.
Matters are very different when it is established through some purely internal spontaneous action
without anything arising to hinder individual initiatives.
That is to say, insofar as people are able to sort of compete and struggle to get to places in the division of labour for which they are suited, and that struggle and competition is not impeded by external constraints, then we'll be okay. So the question is this. What are those external constraints?
What are those external constraints that prevent individuals entering into places for which they are suited? So,
here we have natural abilities. This is Jessica. Natural abilities. And here we have social functions, the division of labor. And here we have some very talented persons, like Jason. Number one, and then Jason number. And the issue is, how is Jason number one going to arrive up here and Jason number two down here? And how is it happen? Jason one might end up. That will be a disaster.
Yeah.
What are the external constraints? What are the external constraints? What does Durkheim talk about? What is Durkheim talking about? What are the external constraints?
Aaron.
Hereditary transmission of wealth. The hereditary transmission of wealth. Page
313.
Very good. Hereditary. And for hereditary. Hereditary transmission of wealth.
What does that mean, Aaron? Why is the hereditary transmission of health, of wealth, an impediment to people getting into the right place?
Because people have more money to do certain
aspects and social functions to get in the way with that aspects to report to unsupervised to
the absolutely. See, we know that Jason number two is in fact the inheritor of an enormous castle. And he is father of an enormous business, newspaper business. So he has an incredible advantage, and though he is equipped to be a janitor, he actually ends up as a professor. And takes toll of his organization in himself and in others.
You're sympathizing with Jason number two, I see. You're laughing at my joke. He can take it.
And equally, Jason number one, you know, he's not a Trotskyist for nothing. He's there before. And he's going to end up down here.
Where are you, Jason number two? What number one?
Where are you?
Ah, there you are.
You're
very shy this semester.
But you still have the Alicia on the outside, and I know that.
Why are you not talking to me, Jason? Okay,
fine. Anyway, get this. This is the hereditary transmission of...
Wealth.
The hereditary transmission of wealth. That's what we have to remove. Now, what does that mean? Yes.
Well, doesn't that say natural ability?
Natural ability and social functions.
Now, if you were all mathematicians, you would know what I was talking about.
But anyway, functions. So the point is this. So what do we do? What does this mean? What does this mean? What is the thing we have to do? Alex. But just more simply than that. We didn't really talk about class very much the first time. That he, what does it mean? You have to remove what? Yeah.
Then it's like even playing
field.
Because
society tries
to open
forms. Hold on. That's very good. First, this one. What does this mean? You even the playing field, you have to eliminate what? You have to eliminate the inheritance of all. What? That's radical stuff. Can you imagine that? No. Nobody in Obama can imagine that. Eliminate inheritance of wealth? What will Marx say? Woo! Let's go. What will Marx say?
Yeah.
Woo. Yeah, but how? What would he say? How would he do it? What would be necessary?
Overthrow
the capitalism revolution. What's your name, revolution in Durkheim? Yes, Jason.
But also the elimination of hereditary poverty, too, at the same time.
Yes. So on page 314, if we go down, on the top of 314,
there I'm told that the hereditary transmission of wealth, the very top line of wealth, suffices to render very unequal external conditions for struggle, since it gives rise to some of the benefits of advantages that do not necessarily correspond to that personal value. If that advantage is just for the richer, and we're the elimination of the meaning of the inheritance of wealth. And then if you drop down to the next paragraph, 346 lines into it, let me read to you. Employment in the public sector is increasingly, this is what he's proposing, is increasingly thrown open freely to everybody with no stipulation as to wealth. Anybody can compete for jobs. Lastly, even this ultimate inequality, that is to say, which springs from the fact that rich and poor exist by birth. The fact of the matter is, even if you eliminate the inheritance of wealth, there still will be people who are born to rich people, because people accumulate wealth. And some people will still earn more than others. That's clearly going to be the case. So some people will be born to more privileged circumstances than others. Some people will have come from families that have a little bit more economic wealth. But they will also have cultural wealth, social wealth. So he's recognizing that. So you've got to eliminate that privilege, ain't it? And employment in the public sector is increasingly thrown open freely to everybody with no stipulation as to wealth. Lastly, even this ultimate inequality, which springs from the fact that rich and poor exist by birth,
rich in social, cultural, and economic capital without disappearing completely is at least somewhat mitigated. Society strives to reduce it as much as possible, these inequalities at work, by helping in various ways those placed into disadvantageous situations and by assisting them to move out of it. What do you call that?
Affirmative action.
Affirmative action is the explicit attempt to take into account and reverse the inequalities of birth. That is the, the American way. Try and compensate for inequalities that we are born with. Through what? Well, through education, but also through affirmative action and employment policy. This is what it's against here. This guy writes in 1891 is talking about employment and affirmative action and public employment. Amazing guy.
Very lovely guy. And then he says, it demonstrates in this way that it feels itself, society feels itself obliged to make room for all the deserving, and that it recognizes as unjust an inferiority that is personally not merited. Personally not merited. It could have come from somebody's speech. Whose speech? Obama's speech in the address. That's what it says. There's a passage there about people being able to achieve and equality to pursue happiness and success. I forgot, I can't reproduce this wonderful language.
So that's the idea here. So basically, Durkheim is suggesting that we have to counteract all those inequalities of birth due to the inheritance, not just of economic capital, but social and cultural capital. That some people come from parents who are more educated, that gives them more, a better chance of moving up in the world. That's got to be counteracted somehow by society. This is a radical project. It's called equality of what?
Equality of opportunity. That's what's going to be important. Yes, equality of opportunity. Yeah.
He actually, on page 321, he even talks about equalizing
physical capacity. Some societies, it's important, he seems to think, to equalize physical capacity to counteract the fact that some species, perhaps women, are weaker than men. I don't know what he had in mind exactly. But anyway, you can look at that page 321. Yes.
So these external conditions, namely the inequality at birth, the inequality due to the transmission of wealth, the inequality due to the fact that some people are born into a richer family background than others, this has to be counteracted, and there has to be every effort made so that Jason number one ends up here and Jason number two down here. Okay.
Yeah. Any questions? Yes, Hannah.
What was the third one?
Oh, I got what I threw on page 321, the inequalities of physical capacity. I don't know if it's a bit of an ambiguous paragraph on that page. It seems to talk about that moment. Yes.
Alright, that's point number one. There are two points to the fourth division of labour. There is one, the link. This is what we talked about now, the link between what? The individual and society.
Individual and society has to promote equality of opportunity.
Actually, what Durkheim says, you'll see in the last chapter, he says, natural abilities, social functions, and reward. So there will be unequal reward, and the reward will be commensurate with the function the individual plays in society. So, natural abilities, social functions, reward. What's this society called?
Jason.
A meritocracy.
That is, people are rewarded according to their merit. They are distributed to positions according to their merit, and then their positions give rise to income according to that position. A meritocracy.
Do we live in a meritocracy?
Kind of.
I mean, if it wasn't a meritocracy, I wouldn't be here.
Okay, very good. The great thing about meritocracy is it provides a ready justification for people to be occupying in elevated positions.
What I was trying to say is when you come from a lower station, economically speaking, as I do, the chances of getting to the spot like Berkeley, should there not be opportunities for merit, are very low.
What
kind of a reward is getting into Berkeley, though?
You learn about that, guys? Reward. But what kind of reward is it? Come on. What kind of reward is it? What kind of reward is it? Whisper, I can't hear you. The next step, right? What's going on here is education, right? All right, engineers and lawyers. What else? What's next?
Doctors.
Back doctors come at the very top, huh? Doctors, engineers, lawyers. Well, I'll put lawyers down here. They deserve to be put a bit below. What else? What else?
Physicists.
All right, natural sciences. What next?
Psychologists.
Whoa. What next?
Business majors.
First one down here. Very good. You know what's going on in this society. Go on, what's next?
Teachers,
very good. Okay, what else? Well, we're into disciplines here, just in university. Education. What's next?
Social work.
I can see you're not going to... Wait, anything down here? What about the economists? Okay, economists, historians, and then right at the bottom, sociology.
Great.
So there's a hierarchy corresponding to here we have a hierarchy of education. The question is, does this correspond to natural abilities? Our sociologist down here.
No.
That's a tricky thing, isn't it? That's what Durkheim is saying. We've got some natural abilities. And they correspond to the position. It's an interesting question. What are these natural abilities? Who defines what these natural abilities are? This is based on society's needs, right? The question is that Durkheim is assuming that there's a parallel of natural abilities. What does Durkheim say? Paula, you said this to me the other day. Remember, Paula, what you said about the natural abilities? You said it's a contradiction to Durkheim's whole claim about... Yes, he only said society comes first and individuals come second. And that's when we've got individuals with natural abilities floating around. Where do they come from? Interesting question, you should think about it. That again is part of the way we think in this world, that somehow we do have distributed natural abilities and they're in some sort of hierarchy. That is how so many societies function in the modern world. Anyway, okay, very good.
Very good. You should think about this picture and what it means in the Durkheimian world.
All right. Very good. Let's move on to the next phase, the next part of the fourth division of labor. We've talked about the linking of individual to society, the individual to the division of labor. Now what are we going to talk about? What's the second part of this chapter about? What is the second part, Simeon?
Justice between what and what?
What
is it? Read out.
Equality in the external conditions of the struggle is not only needed to secure each individual to his function, but also to link these functions with one another.
It's not just a matter of linking individuals to functions, but functions to one another. What does that mean? Simeon.
You need contracts, I guess.
You need contracts, but not just right. You have contracts relating individuals, workers to capitalists, husbands and wives. There, I know.
Between management and labor, that's a contractual relationship. And what is Durkheim saying about that relationship? What is Durkheim saying about that relationship?
You don't know. Anybody know?
Come on. Yes, Annie.
It has to be fair.
What does that mean?
So the two parties, the value, the exchange has to be equal.
Yes, so when I deliver a certain amount of effort, 8 hours of exhausting work in this factory called the University of California, I have to be compensated equivalently. And that no external body must be interfere to make that wage sort of less than what is equivalent to the enormous effort I put in. So what he is saying here is that there must be, he's saying, well, let's read page 316.
319. You can read 318, 319, very important pages, but 2, 4, 6, 8 lines from the top. 8 lines from the top of 319.
Yeah, wait, I'm not here today, right?
Now you get full marks for honesty and straightforwardness. Very good. According to the situation, management can exist without workers, but workers cannot exist without managers, because if their survival, then there is an unequal, unjust relationship. There should be mutual reciprocity. What does he say? If one class in society is obliged in order to live, that is to say, if the working class in society is obliged in order to live to secure the acceptance by others of its services, whilst another class, the capitalist class, can do without them because of the resources already at its disposal, resources that, however, are not necessarily the result of some solution of social superiority but most likely inherited, the latter group, the capitalist, can lord it over the former, the workers. So that is going to be an unjust relationship, unjust contract, and it's not going to lead to solidarity, it's going to lead to conflict, struggle. And therefore, Durkheim says, you've got to do what? You've got to introduce social justice between two sides. And therefore, how do you do that? How do you do that, Anders? Norwegian that you are, you should know.
Lord, well, you can do that. What happens in Norway when you lose your job?
You get welfare.
You get welfare.
You do for a few hours in the United States, too.
Yeah, you get welfare. So that means you're not totally dependent on capital for survival.
Right?
You get welfare, and also there's a regulation of the relation between capital and labor. There's limits on what managers can do to workers, the conditions under which they fire workers. You get that, Liz?
But if this inequality comes from social superiority, is that okay?
No! He's saying if it comes from somehow. If it comes from the, if it comes by virtue of the fact that managers are managers because of their entrepreneurial skills and talents, not because their fathers were rich business, but if it comes from innate talents, then indeed it's okay. But always it is the case that those workers must not be dependent upon capital any more than capital is dependent upon workers. So basically, workers are going to have this guaranteed welfare, and there's going to be a regulation of the social relationship. Okay, it's not sufficient to say just that the capitalist has not inherited wealth. It's also the relationship itself has to be just. Okay, Jason.
Okay. Now, yes. So what
Durkheim is saying here is that between the different parts of society there has to be a certain reciprocity, relationships of justice. There has to be an equalization of power between parts, as well as the equality of opportunity.
Yeah. This is radical stuff.
This is radical stuff. This would require the transformation of the society in which we live today, here. You want me? Oh, very good. See, this is a sort of interlude, keeps you awake. Okay, let's look at 321. 321, 322. 321, 322. Yes. Yes, okay, I want to read to you, it's just a continuation of the same point, the new paragraph on 321, line 4.
There Durkheim says, the new paragraph on 3.1, just as, are you there, Jason?
I am.
Very good, why don't you read it out then?
Okay, just as the ideal of modern societies was to create or maintain a common life as intense as possible.
To maintain a strong collective consciousness.
In which the individual was engulfed, ours is to interject an even greater equity into our social relationships in order to ensure the free development of all those forces that are socially useful.
Very good. Very much so. Almost sounds like Marx. Listen to this. Just as the ideal of lower societies was to create or maintain a common life as intense as possible, that is a strong collective consciousness in which the individual was engulfed.
Ours is to inject an even greater equity into our social relations, greater equity into social relations, social justice, in order to ensure the free development of all those forces that are socially useful. The free development of all those social forces that are useful. What are those social forces? They are none other than the talent that individuals have. So basically, and the relations to which they will enter. So basically the idea is to introduce notions of social justice, social equality that will liberate our capacities to engage with one another in the division of labor. And if we turn on the next page, the last paragraph, last five lines of the chapter. Just as ancient peoples had above all the need of a common faith to live by, a religion, we have need of
justice. We can rest assured that this need will become ever more pressing if, as everything leads us to foresee, the conditions that dominate social evolution remain unchanged. We can rest assured that this need for social justice will become ever more pressing if, as everything leads us to foresee, the conditions that dominate social evolution remain unchanged. Well, it's not clear what he's going to get at, but it seems to suggest that social justice is an emergent common belief, almost a religion, that we characterize in modern society. Okay, we're now in a position to fill this box. Who's worried about this box? Lauren, right? Yes. Yes.
Here it is.
Yes, go ahead.
Why is there a hierarchy of conditions if we're all equal and we have this reciprocity
and the
janitor
such
the same,
because
one is needed by...
We are not. There is a hierarchy. Let me see if I
can find quickly the appropriate
Three thirty-eight. Whoa. Yeah, 338, 339. Yeah, am I right? There's some beautiful passages. Well, there's only really one beautiful one. What about... Yes.
Has somebody got a very good way to talk explicitly about 339, 40? I think that's probably the best. See, all throughout he's talking about the unequal talents, the natural abilities.
Let me talk about 338. Let me just read to you the last paragraph of 338. Nothing can be lost from this. Okay, he says there, but the mere existence of rules regulating the division of labor is not sufficient. They must also be just. For this, the external conditions of competition should be equal. If, on the other hand, we call to mind that the collective consciousness is increasingly reduced to the cult of the individual, we shall see that the characteristic of morality in organized societies compared to segmentary societies is that it possesses something more human and consequently more rational about it. It does not cause our activity to depend upon ends that do not directly concern us. It does not make us the servants of some ideal powers, completely different in nature from ourselves, powers who follow their own course without heeding the interests of men. It requires us only to be charitable and just towards our fellow men, to fulfill our task well, to work towards a state where everyone is called to fulfill the function he performs best and will receive a just reward for his efforts.
Well, doesn't exactly say that there is a hierarchy here. Where can somebody help me? No? Aaron? Well, previously on page 339, in the middle, you said that there's a place that each person merits.
Where's that? On the just desserts then?
We feel only too well.
We feel that 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11, 12 lines down on 339, he says, we feel only too well how laborious the task it is to erect such a society, one in which each individual will have the place he merits and will be rewarded according to his deserts, where everyone will consequently cooperate spontaneously, both for the common good and that of the individual. Right. Yeah. Well, you could search for more, but essentially what Durkheim presupposes, and you're right for that to question is, he assumes that there is a hierarchy of natural abilities. And that corresponds to a hierarchy of social functions. That some functions are more important than others. And skill may be, skill and prestige may correspond to that. Okay? Now what your question was?
Well, I'm just wondering why there's a hierarchy of the position.
Yeah.
We're kind of interdependent on each other.
Yes, that's right. He's got an idea that somehow the managers are higher in the hierarchy than workers, but each is dependent upon the other. So there is a hierarchy based on these dependents. Tricky, huh? He believes that, you know, and as so we do in society, that societies are fundamentally hierarchical and should be so, but he's also trying to say that there should be social justice between the different levels of the hierarchy. So we're not getting rid of hierarchies. So that, of course, is different from the what? The realm of freedom and the communism. Okay, very good. Well, alright. Let's try to think. Can you, I'm going to put the picture that goes in here, so that you will not miss it. So here, see, these are the external conditions. External conditions. This is what? This is inheritance of wealth. This is the inequality. Inequality of opportunity. This is injustice. And what you have to do is, says Durkheim, is you eliminate these external inequalities. And so that then there will be a matching of natural talents and social positions. And then you will move to this situation. Natural abilities, social functions. This is the spontaneous division of labor. This is the abnormal division of labor with those external inequalities. The abnormal division of labor. This is the normal division of labor. This is tribute solidarity. This is conflict. And what is Durkheim saying? He says you've got to get rid of, you've got to have equality of opportunity. And you've got to have social justice. In order to go from the abnormal to the normal. This is the picture that goes in here.
Tracy.
You're going to be really mad at me for this question, but it's kind of...
It's impossible to be mad at you, Tracy.
Go back to what she was saying.
Uh-huh.
How do you remove the external conditions when the internal conditions are what's causing it in the first place? So the natural abilities are what's causing that in the first place. Because some people are naturally better at being a doctor than somebody who's sewing. And they're going to make more money because they have that natural ability. So how do you remove that when that's causing that?
Right. That's the problem.
Okay.
So, yes. So, somebody is talented to be a doctor,
right,
as opposed to be a janitor.
Right.
Or
so they're naturally going to make more money.
And will make more money. That's part of the meritocracy.
Right.
Reward. And therefore, their children, the children of the doctor, may have a little bit more money to feed, to educate their children than the janitor. And therefore, what has to happen? Society has to compensate for that inequality by creating as much equality of opportunity as possible. That is the project.
And you're not
so incredibly radical.
But you're not removing the transmittal of wealth from heredity. You're just kind of balancing it out.
So, right, how do you balance it out? That's all right. That's how you balance
it. Well, I was going to say kind of the same thing. And, like, he talked about, like, wage being, like, equivalent to the amount of work put out. But if there's, like, a need for specific social functions, like, it just seems like some people are just screwed, like, by natural talent.
They're going to earn less because they are actually doing. Yes.
So, is there, like, I guess, like have to take faith in the fact that they belong to something bigger than them.
Yes, that's exactly right. Have to take faith they belong to something bigger. They'll feel part of that bigger thing. But also what will happen, can you now use your sociological imagination? What sort of society would actually be able to compensate for these inequalities? So we don't want to disadvantage the children of the janitor.
Right.
So how do we avoid that? How do we avoid that? How do we avoid that? Think. Durkheim doesn't tell us, but you've got to think to see how radical this guy is, Matthew.
Well, the one answer that comes to my mind is just taxation and redistributing.
Yes, you could, but you know, then it becomes meaningless to have that differential award. Durkheim insists that that differential award is important as a measure of the prestige and standing of these different positions. People will be happy to be janitors because they will feel unity with all, and they will accept that they will earn less, but their children will not be disadvantaged. How can we avoid that disadvantage? Jason. The man's got a sociological he's got sociological imagination. Yes. Go on, more. Brilliant.
So that the kids of the janitors and the kids of the doctors are not incorporated to see themselves as destined to be such and such.
Right. So are there any examples of this in the world today? Or the world yesterday? Yes.
Greece has that one. Mm. That's society, right?
Greece.
Okay.
Maybe.
I don't know if they registered
it to
the children, but.
Yeah, but yes, well, that one in the ancient Greeks. Yes. Maybe, but haven't we done that with the ancient Greeks? Yes, Neil.
One kind of example is the army. There's a guy in my unit who went to an Ivy League school, but there's a general that used the E4 to be sponsored around by guys who.
Yes, the army is an equalizing unit, but that's late on in life already, and he'll leave the army, don't worry about it, right?
Well, no, he's got a grocery store.
Big slum somewhere, yeah. He's okay, but no, it has to be done early on, Juliana.
Well, the first example that came to my mind was when Native American children were put in boarding schools.
Uh-huh.
And the justification for that was like, oh, these children are disadvantaged because they're uncivilized and we're going to help them.
That's a civilizing mission. It's not exactly Durkheim's project, but it's the idea of bringing up a larger society in the world, but actually make a sort of progressive principle was the foundation of that society. Huh? No? Yes? Right? Christy? No? Please, somebody. Yes? Nothing. Yes, Alex.
It's just a guess.
Yeah, good as a guess.
I guess it's either China or the Soviet Union.
China or the Soviet Union. Well, that's an interesting case because, of course, what happens in China or the Soviet Union? You know, to some extent, of course, the inheritance of wealth for us. There was inheritance, however, of cultural capital. The educated classes were able to pass on their education. There were advantages, but it was more like the system than the United States. However, it was a totalitarian, authoritarian political order that enforced it. In some sense, that has real close parallels indeed to the Durkheimian project. There wasn't some genuine equality, more so than, of course, a society like this one. Yes, but what else? Yes, Jerica.
Well, going up the China one, it reminds me of their, like, Olympics program. From rural areas.
Yeah, so that's a thing. Yes, so the Chinese are extremely good at sort of, in a sort of quite authoritarian way, of sort of imposing some sort of equality, so there's equality of two. But there's another society which is called Israel. Which is what? Have I heard of it? No. Oh,
I
couldn't think of a word.
I was begging Matt to help me, and he did not. I was talking.
Yeah, well, what do you expect? Yeah. I'm really insulting everybody today. Yes, Kristen, tell me about the keyboards. Keyboard sim.
Just going
for
there, right?
No. Okay. Rachel, you know about it, yeah?
Kind of.
Let's hear.
They're kind of communist everywhere.
Everybody works, and the children are taken away and they're looked after. Collectively.
Yeah. I mean, kibbutzim has lost its original goal.
But it was an amazing sort of utopian project there too. Small scale society.
The point is, I really want to get across to you that this project is an incredibly radical one when you think about its implications. Right, Tracy?
Yeah, you're not very convinced about
it. No. So yes. He's actually explicitly advocating the elimination of the inheritance of wealth. And he's talking about equality of opportunity. And he's talking about social justice between management and worker. Yes, there still will be hierarchies. And of course, how does this relate to Marx and Engels? Yes, Sienna.
The idea of equality
corresponding
to the
function of
basically their whole
promise
of communism.
Is what?
This is like the basis of their
promise
of communism that you can do whatever you want with your
world. Do you think that Marx and Engels believe in natural abilities? Do they believe in hierarchies? Do they believe in divisions of labor? Communism is the what?
The abolition of
the division of labor. And in the realm of freedom, it is the development of what? Neil? Your multifaceted abilities. You're not specializing in multifaceted abilities. You're not in a hierarchy. There's no gap between, there's no sort of
say social functions, here's natural abilities.
No, we are together relating to one another with a view to developing our rich and their abilities. So in some sense, this vision of the future is a radical one. This vision is a radical one, but it's not the communist one. It's not the communist one. What happens to the state here? What happens to the state here? Book 2, chapter 7, yes, Nick. For who? For Marx and Engels, it withered away. For Durkheim, hands up. Alex. Achoo. Not us. Get bigger. So again, there are big differences here. Get bigger. For Durkheim, the state becomes more and more it regulates and reproduces the social justice, equality, and opportunity. It ensures that there is a matching of natural and natural ability, social functions. It ensures the regulation of the division of labor with a view to social justice. Yeah, it's a bigger and bigger state, whereas for Marx and Engels, the closest state was the way, yes, Neil?
Do you know
the way
people actually identify their natural talents?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it? As soon as we hear natural talents, oh, who's to say?
Who's got certain natural talents? Somebody just says, someone who's got talents to be a doctor as opposed to.
No, we have no way. No way. And no, but come on, there are many more problems with this. There are many more problems with this. Look. Look, there are natural abilities, and here are social functions. What's he assuming? Yes or no?
There's still a contradiction in the sense that even though there's not this inheriting, wealth, there's still this idea that as a janitor, my children can be something more.
They may or may not be. They also may be destined to be janitors.
Right, but because there's still that hierarchy of functions and positions, my child is still going to want to do those things. And where is my position going to be? I mean, I'm still needed in society as a janitor or as a whatever I am. So that's still contradictory.
Well, no, you won't be the janitor, and your children will be doctors.
Right, and then everyone
will want to
be doctors.
No, the point is that it's not everybody. That's exactly the point, Claire. You've got your finger on the million-dollar issue here. Not everybody can be doctors. But what Durkheim is assuming, he's assuming what? He's assuming something here. You actually got your finger on it, Claire. What's he assuming here?
Doing that the social functions are
somehow
equated with some natural ability that comes
naturally.
Yes,
but what's he assuming here? He's assuming that there is, yes,
smart. Well, I was just kind of thinking, he's assuming that there's not going to rise any sort of prestige with that. Because,
well, what's he assuming? And just looking at these two triangles, what's he assuming?
That they're matched, I guess?
Yes! That they are matched, I am, yes? That they are matched! But actually, the distribution of functions is the same. So basically, if there are doctors up here, we only need a few doctors. We only have a few doctors needed here, and there are only these people with the talents for a few doctors. And, well, the reality may be something like this. Most of us may be very talented in society, only very few with lesser talents, and the functions of society may look like this. And what happens then? What happens now? Very good. Man or me? Struggle? Eternal conflict? The question is, how is it that these two are matched? How is it that the two triangles look the same? Well, there's two answers to that question. Either the natural abilities get shifted to fit the social functions, or the social functions get shifted to fit the natural abilities. And you should examine Durkheim to see if he's got an answer one way or the other. But I want to impress upon you very strongly that this is an incredibly radical project. It may not be the Marxist one, but what he is asking us to do is eliminate the inheritance of wealth, eliminate the inheritance of social, cultural, and economic capital. He is interested in maybe social justice between groups, between partners. And the question is, how on earth is he going to get there? How is he going to go from the abnormal to the normal? Marx would say, how? You can only go through revolution. The capitalists and people who own the private property are not going to keel over and hand over. No. So what is Durkheim's answer? What is Durkheim's answer to the question, how are we going to move from that normal to normal? See ya.
Change where else?
Yeah. Very good. I think he believes that we will be increasingly infused with a commitment to social justice. And that a collective consciousness, weak though it is, will be what will drive from the abnormal to the normal. And it is true that one could argue over the last 150 years in advanced capitalist societies that we have been infused by notions of social justice, and to some extent, with blips along the way, there has been more social justice in society over the last 150 years. Yes, Simeon?
Isn't that coming like full circle back to the utopian
socialist? Utopian socialist? Well, the ones that Marx and Engels are criticizing.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. This, one could argue that this is a sort of utopian socialism. You know, it's based on meritocracy, equality of opportunity, social justice. It's not communism, but it's utopian. And the question that Marx and Engels will always pose to Durkheim is, how on earth are you going to get there? And Durkheim only seems to be able to say, well, somehow the collective consciousness will force that change. He has no real good answer. But I still want to demonstrate to you that this will persuade you that this is an incredibly radical project. Incredibly radical. You want to finish, don't you, Julia? Well, Sasha's got one question and then you'll be free. Hold on. Yes, Sasha. Come to the review section if you want to talk about Gramsci. 4 o'clock in 1 minute.
So there would say this line applies to us as well.
Yes.